BizNews Power Hour.
Well, welcome. It's Monday. It's the 8th of November, and we are coming to you all around the country. Well, that depends on if you're streaming or not. We certainly are on Fine Music Radio in Cape Town and High FM in Johannesburg, and we being the BizNews team with the Power Hour. I'm Alec Hogg, and today I had a chat with Phil Craig from the Cape Independence Movement, talking about why the local elections were such good news for those who want the Cape to be seceding from the rest of South Africa. But apart from that and our colleagues at the Financial Times in London, this is almost the Justin Rowe Roberts show. Justin, you've got three interviews that you can quickly give us a little bit of a feel for. David Shapiro, first up, as always on a Monday. Do you have much interesting information to impart today?
Of course, Mr. Shapiro had some interesting information to share with us. Obviously, lots happening in the financial markets, whether it be global or local. Shapiro, a big advocate for the U.S. growth companies. We've seen Moderna and Peloton, Moderna being a big pharma company and Peloton being an online fitness business. They came off quite aggressively last week. So David Shapiro was just telling us why that happened. And then he was going into some of the local companies, MTN, the Purple Group, and to name a few. And thereafter,
the Purple Group is making us very happy. We have it in the BizNews portfolio. I think we bought it at about 1.30 rand. Today, last I looked, it was at 2.20 rand on a trading update.
Yeah, incredible returns coming from the Purple Group. We're seeing Easy Equity starting to generate money. It's that exponentiality you look for in your BizNews portfolio companies, Alec, and you're getting that from the Purple Group. Easy Equity starting to generate revenues. And it's that almost that J curve, you lose money for a period of time before you see those exponential returns.
And they are indeed. I guess Sanlam is very happy because they bought 30% of the company for what now looks like an absolute song. You also had a chat with Andre Celia from Treasury One, all about the Rand. Is he optimistic?
He is relatively optimistic. He thinks that the strength that came end of last week will persist and that we'll get closer to the 14.50 rand levels come year end. But all those decisions, he says, has to do with what the Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, does in the U.S. and what the governor of the Reserve Bank here locally does in the next rate decision.
So lots more information there, but Justin's given us some good insights. And then, Nadia, you were, of course, at the conference. I know you've also been working really hard. This is the BizNews Investment Conference, of course. You've been working really hard on that incredible presentation that Jason McCormick gave us, looking at, I think it was called 72 Hours of Anarchy.
72 Hours of Anarchy, yeah, it was absolutely excellent. Nearly ready for YouTube.
So it's something to look out for. We know that the headline act at the conference so far as YouTube downloads are concerned, was Rob Herzog. How many people have watched that now?
I think collectively part one and part two, almost 500,000.
That's extraordinary. Half a million people.
And it's still growing. I mean, it hasn't got the same momentum, but still. And people went wild over it in good and bad ways.
Well, that's Rob Herzog, who is certainly no shrinking violet. And if you haven't seen what he said at the BizNews Investment Conference, that's well worth going on to YouTube and just put BizNews TV and you'll get all Nadia's work there. But Jason McCormick, the man who is the next headline act, if you like, on BizNews TV, and it's coming up very shortly, he also is the chief executive of a listed company, Justin, and you had a chat with him.
Yes, he's the CEO of Exemplar, so the McCormacks. They're property moguls, the family. They've got a lot of listed and unlisted investments. Exemplar is their listed vehicle. And most of the developments are in the rural areas. Of course, those rural areas were the ones that got impacted by the July riots. That's majority of KZN and parts of Gauteng. 5 out of the 23 of their properties were affected. But in the last 4 months, a lot has changed. And the McCormack family and Exemplar shareholders have a lot to be upbeat about. It's a really intriguing interview. And it's good to hear that things in the rural areas are going really well post-July riots.
Well, we'll be hearing that interview in a little while. If you can imagine that Jason McCormick, who we saw at the BizNews conference and telling us about everything that he'd gone through, And not only has he actually stayed in South Africa, but he's continuing to invest and they're putting more money in there. And we'll hear more from Justin and Jason in just a little while. RightRock believes that with every change in life comes opportunity and the markets aren't any different. The daily movement in the markets means change for us all, sometimes small, sometimes big. This daily market report is made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes. And I think the team at BrightRock are about as happy as the rest of South Africa are after the Springboks finally breaking that hoodoo against Wales on the weekend. Nadja, I know it's kind of a boys' game, but did you watch?
I was out and it was on a big screen, so I shared the joy.
You shared the joy. Isn't that lovely?
Yes.
Well, share some joy on the news headlines for today with us, will you?
Political parties may be looking to play a longer game, opting to build relationships and partnerships to take power in the 2024 national election rather than enter into destructive coalitions to gain the upper hand in municipalities now. The DA this weekend made it clear that it will not enter into any coalitions with the ANC and the EFF following the volatility it suffered post-2016 when the EFF scuppered its agreements over policy issues. The DA said it would rather form strong oppositions in hung municipalities than work with parties who are not on the same page. The ANC has expressed similar sentiments, saying it is happy to be the opposition in areas it has lost. And South Africa's load shedding crisis could escalate as Eskom's relationship with service providers has reportedly soured to the point that critical work at the Kusile power stations has stopped. A contractual dispute with Eskom has reportedly led to work on conveyor belts needed to transport coal to the plant ceasing. This has been ongoing for 2 weeks. The work stopped after Eskom stopped paying the company handling the process. The power utility said it stopped the payments to offset overpayments of around 500 million rand that it has made over the years. And South African consumers will have to dig deeper in their pockets at the tills this festive season, with food prices set to rise on the back of rising petrol prices, feed and input costs. This week, the price of petrol increased to a record 19.54 rand by 1.21 rand a litre, an increase that will exacerbate the already high cost of food, analysts say. The recent fuel price does not bode well for the inflation profile in the short to medium forecast horizon, particularly food inflation. This is also exacerbated by the fact that there are other cost push pressures like fertilizer costs and electricity costs, Kulani Suweye, AgriSA's chief economist, told Business Insider. And now it's to Justin for the market report.
Thanks, Dodds. The JSE All Share Index was lower at 67,700. In the currency markets, the rand was stronger against all the major currencies, 15 rand to the dollar, 20 rand 29 cents to the pound, and 17 rand 37 cents to the euro. Gold is up at $1,820 an ounce. A Kruger rand will cost around 29,000 rand. Brent crude is $83.90 a barrel, and Bitcoin is trading around the million rand level. In the financial news, MTN Group recently made a takeover approach for Telkom in a deal that would have combined South Africa's second and third largest telecommunication operators, according to people familiar with the matter. Telkom has so far shown no interest in a sale, said the people, who asked to remain private as the talks are confidential. It remains unclear whether the larger rival will continue its pursuit, the people said. There's no deal on the table in relation to this matter, MTN said in a statement after Bloomberg inquiries, declining further comment. A representative for Telkom didn't immediately comment. Following a multi-year asset disposal program, MTN is flush with cash and looking to build on its core business. A combination with Telkom would help close the gap with crosstown rival Vodacom, South Africa's largest market leader.
This daily market report was made just for you by BrightRock, the first ever needs-matched life insurance that changes as your life changes.
Today is Monday, November 8th, and this is your FT News Briefing. British industrialist Sanjeev Gupta faces more scrutiny of his business operations, this time from authorities in France. And in the US, President Joe Biden is pushing ahead with his next giant spending bill. Plus, they have glamorous lifestyles and make insanely high salaries. So why can't some pro athletes keep their finances straight?
there are some guys now 18 years old and they're earning £10,000 a week. And when it comes to that level, you can easily lose yourself.
Yes, that was British football legend Sol Campbell. He was on the FT's Money Clinic podcast. We'll bring you some of that conversation. I'm Mark Filippino, and here's the news you need. French authorities are investigating the business operations of Sanjeev Gupta. That's the UK industrialist once known as Britain's savior of steel. But his empire is under scrutiny because of its close links to the failed supply chain finance company Greensill Capital. Now, the Paris prosecutor's office told the FT it's probing Gupta's French operations over allegations of misuse of corporate assets and money laundering. Gupta's GFG alliance has several important assets in France. They were amassed during a multi-billion dollar acquisition spree financed by Greensill. Paris prosecutors say they launched their probe in July after public officials reported suspicious activities. They declined to provide details. President Joe Biden is pushing ahead with plans to transform the U.S. economy. Just last week, lawmakers passed the president's $1.2 trillion infrastructure bill. Now Biden is vowing to pass an even larger spending bill that would invest in a broad range of social programs. He's pushing forward even as his popularity has ebbed and after his political party took a hit in state and local elections last week. The FT's U.S. political correspondent Lauren Fedor says the White House plans to pass the Build Back Better bill by the end of the month.
That would obviously be another victory for the White House, but particularly it would be a victory for them when it comes to not only appealing to voters, many of whom polling indicates support a lot of the measures that are included in this bill, but also progressives within his own party who have really been pushing the president to, you know, go big, do more when it comes to these kind of legislative ambitions, particularly when we have only 1 year left till the midterm elections. And at that point, we could see the Democrats losing control of Congress and maybe not having another chance, really, at doing something like this.
Lauren Fedor covers U.S. politics for the Financial Times. Professional athletes may have short careers, but they can have huge earnings. And they often find themselves swimming in money that they're not equipped to manage. Some even end up in dire straits. The FT's Claire Barrett spoke to some British footballers about this for her Money Clinic podcast, and she joins me now. Hi, Claire.
Oh, thanks for having me, Mark.
So, Claire, you didn't speak to just any British footballer, and I'm going to put aside my American vernacular for a second, not say soccer player for this one. Claire, you spoke to the one and only Sol Campbell. For those who aren't familiar with him, tell us who he is and why he's a big deal.
Okay, so Sol Campbell, he is a legend of English football. I mean, he has played for some of our top teams, like Arsenal. He's been in the English national team. And in his day, he was one of the highest earning Premier League footballers. And he's a famous pundit talking about football on TV. So he's really a national institution in the UK.
Okay, so he knows the game inside and out. I want to play a clip of what he told you about footballers and money.
There are some guys now 18 years old, 17 years old, and they're earning £10,000 a week and more. And when it comes to that level, you really got to, you know, watch yourself because you can easily lose yourself. If you have a good head on your shoulders and you've got good people around you, you're okay, but if you haven't got that, you can end up losing so much money. And in time you're 25 and 27, 28, you've got no investment other than your house.
So, Claire, what makes young athletes so vulnerable to mismanaging their money? What does all this money at a young age do to these athletes?
There is just enormous temptation to spend, but also to do pretty risky things like gambling the money away, punting it on high risk investments like crypto. There's quite a lot of neurological research that's actually coming to the fore now to say that people who are in risky professions like footballers are kind of perhaps more drawn to risky activities such as gambling. Another perhaps more traditional way to lose lots of money, getting divorced. And then finally, the amount of financial scams that are targeted at footballers who are, like many of us, got lots of money, but they haven't got much time to look into things. So they maybe trust advisors that they shouldn't really trust. Don't look into these things, sign up, and then find out years later that they're on the hook for a massive tax bill.
Okay, so this is all in the context of football players. Are there any financial lessons for us non-athletes?
It's a fantastic example of why we all need a bit of financial planning in our lives. There's an awful lot that mere mortals, non-sports people like myself, can take away from this, thinking about the future, making plans for retirement, being prepared for that curveball that could come and hit you. You know, in the case of Gareth, it was having a horrific accident. In the case of other footballers, it's just having an injury. It can happen at any time, you know, and then your salary can be gone, can be lost to you. And just putting plans in place for how you're going to transition to the next stage of your career, or ultimately how you're going to make money in retirement, how the investments that you make today are going to provide for you in the future. And whether you've got a lot of money or a little money, these are all things that we need to be thinking about.
Claire Barrett is the FT's consumer editor and the host of the FT's Money Clinic podcast. Thank you, Claire.
Well, thanks for having me.
And before we go, new week, new reminder that right now the FT is giving away all the journalism on our site for free. This comes with a 30-day trial to the FT's Moral Money newsletter, which tracks socially responsible investing. So you get the newsletter free for a month and the whole of FT.com without paying a dime or a pence or a lira. You know, you get the point. Sign up at FT.com/COP26podcast. Well, this has been your daily FT news briefing. Make sure you check back tomorrow for the latest business news.
I'm Joshua Roberts of BizNews, and with me for today's market insights is Sasfin Securities' David Shapiro. Let's start with interesting price movements in the U.S. last week, with Moderna and Peloton both in free fall. Two very different companies, with Moderna a pharma business, whilst Peloton an online fitness business. What were the reasons for the sharp downturn?
Just disappointing results from Moderna. I think the market had built in far better delivery of vaccines. But Justin, that whole space is becoming very competitive with Pfizer the leader, you know, and it's a matter of who gets the vaccines out, how effective these vaccines are, and I'm not criticizing Moderna, but also now that Pfizer has announced a pill, in other words, treatment for COVID. If you've got COVID, if you have it early, and the results have been very good, so I think that can be a game changer, because it's going to make people feel confident. If I get it, I know I've got a pull. So a lot's happening in that area, and it's difficult to know who the winners are, but at the moment, Pfizer leading by a long head.
And Peloton, David?
Peloton, the ideal company for lockdown. Gym at home, great online classes, wonderful equipment. But all of a sudden, you know, when people start getting out again, very difficult to maintain that. And I think the fact that people want to go out, I think they want to go to gyms. Gym, you know, don't ignore gym as it's a place where you gather, where you see other people, etc. Being at home can be very, very boring, you know, despite the fact that they have these wonderful competitions amongst each other, etc. You still want to go out and see mates and those kind of things. So disappointing. I hope they come back, because it's a good company with a good product.
Staying on the US theme, Elon Musk tweeted whether he should sell 10% of his Tesla stake. He said he'll abide by the results of the Twitter poll, which did vote in favor of the sale. Are you for or against this kind of tomfoolery by Elon Musk, for lack of a better word?
I just watch him, but I've got to tell you something that I was quite... we use a lot of international bankers for advice, and all of a sudden they started to turn positive, because EVs are so much in the vogue at the moment. And by, you know, no doubt that that Tesla is a leader. So you can't ignore the business. I mean, he's worth over $300 billion. Buffett came out with his results. We always used to call Buffett the richest man. I mean, he's about a quarter of the wealth, or even less than that, of Musk. So I, you know, and he's a maverick, and the fact that I think he needs money, And should I sell or shouldn't? I think he wanted to sell in any case. He's got so many other projects in that, but you can't play him. You know what I mean? He's unplayable, Elon. But credit to him and what he's achieved. I just, and he's from South Africa, you know, so we can produce people like that.
Certainly very interesting. Another interesting topic, Harry Smith, the representative for the Ascendus Activist Investors. He was appointed to the board of Ascendus on Friday. Is this an inflection point for activist investors specifically in South Africa?
I hope so. You know, by that, I hope we get more involvement in companies. I just saw Richemont today. Okay, that's South African company. Loeb, who's a hedge fund trader. I can't remember. Is it David Loeb? I can't remember his first name. But he's an activist. And obviously he sees value there, or he needs a little bit. And it's great. It keeps people on the board. You know, you don't want to get too comfortable sitting in the chairman or in the CEO's position. And I think it's just, sometimes they might overdo it, but you still want them to be, you still want somebody there looking, you know, on behalf of shareholders, trying to extract value. I'm skeptical about non-executive directors. You know, I would rather have an activist than a non-exec director looking after me. So yeah, I hope we see a lot more, because there's so many businesses, and I'll even start with Remgro, you know, that can extract a lot more than we have. Everything's been a little too comfortable for these chaps.
Speculation on Bloomberg this morning that MTN are in talks to buy out Telkom. Do you see this as a realistic possibility?
How they're going to allow, they won't allow it. I think the competition, authorities won't allow it. It just gives them too much power. I like where MTN's going. And I haven't been a great favorite. I've been, you know, on record. I've said it's a utility, no growth there. But now that we're seeing, you know, fintech, we're seeing payment systems, that puts it into a new game. Yes, it's small at the moment, you know, relative to the overall income there, but a good move. Why they want Telkom, I'm not too sure. You know, I'm not, I hope they're not after the fixed line business, you know, I can't see that going through. You know, with only three viable competitors, I don't know if we count Cell C anymore. I think it's impossible that they let it go through. So I don't know. We'll see. But watch that space. I've suddenly, you know, for me, it's been revived. I mean, this could be big.
There aren't too many South African fintech companies. MTN comes to mind. The Purple Group too. That's the holding company for Easy Equities. They posted a trading update on Friday. It was upbeat. Their financials are coming in this week, so we don't have too much information to report on. But what's your feedback from that trading update that came on Friday?
Well, you know, Easy Equities have done a brilliant job. And one uses them as an example to highlight that there's still thousands of people out there, investors, who want to buy shares, you know, and they've made it very easy and very available. And it's something that brokers don't do, that we should be doing. And, you know, I like to promote it because I like to promote private ownership. You know, instead of buying a passive, this place, don't get me wrong, this place for ETFs and their place for unit trusts and that. But I find a lot more excitement around, around buying individual stocks, and they've made it available. And if you're a young person and you want to build your wealth, you can do incredibly well. You know, when we look, you look at Purple, I don't know, they're up how many 100%, you know, this, you know, brilliant. You know, how many 100%? I don't know, a couple of 100%. Compare that with, MySpace or Process, which is down 15%. You know, if you would have bought some Purple as an individual, just look how well you've done. And that's not only NetOne, let's name them, even MTN. There've been some brilliant performances, and I still think we're going into an exciting area, you know, where your companies like Purple will outperform the overall index.
Swift change of topic from fintech to your more boring brick and mortar construction. Rabex announced good results on the back of a record order book. Are these the signposts that the infrastructure drive is being implemented and that these struggling construction businesses are benefiting as a result, finally?
Take care. That's exactly right. I think, you know what, when I went through it, and I'm, you know, I like to look at businesses that are growing, and suddenly the signs are there. And they tell you, you know, you don't have to look for the sign. The company tells you. The government offering a lot more tenders. Things are happening. Take heed, you know, in other words. And the operational gearing from where they are at the moment is intense. You know, this reminds me of 205. I started the 2010 fund in those areas mainly because Thabo Mbeki at that stage said we're going to spend $150 billion. Okay, that's in 205 terms, you know, on infrastructure. And that's, you know, the World Cup and so on and roads and everything. And companies were in a similar position. I think we're starting to see the early signs of big spend on infrastructure and businesses themselves. So, yeah, I'm starting to look at Robex, Afrimat, you name it. Let's, you know, have a closer look.
David, do you just want to outline some of the risks that come with investing in these junior miners?
Look, people take me wrong because I tweeted something. They're constantly coming out with statements about how big the helium resource is, and I'm not there to question it. But what I've known is it's like an exploration company. They found the resource. They've got the ability to make money. Now they've got to turn it into profit. When I looked at their accounts, you know, they're not making any money at the moment, and they've got a massive debt of $500 million with a net worth of only $280 million, yet the share price is at $5 billion. Now, that can happen if they can turn the resource into income and deliver the helium or whatever it is. I'm not questioning that. All I know is it takes a lot of money to do that, a lot of time and years, and you've got to raise money. So all I'm saying to people out there who are pushing up this share price, just be careful. You know, I'm not questioning that it can't be a good business, but I think maybe the share price was running a little too ahead of itself, and they need to calm down a bit. That's all, you know, that's all. But, you know, I'm not putting a curse on him. I just hope that he can do something. And I've no doubt somewhere along the line, some big brother or some big company will recognize this and buy it out. Whether they buy it out for $5 billion, Justin, I don't know. That's a question that's up to analysts. And we've never had helium before. I think on the JSE, I've traded in everything else, but not helium.
How does business empower our nation? By bringing produce to our tables, giving us technology that connects us, hospitals that care for us, and the tools that shape our cities. And by backing the next generation of business owners. That's why South Africa banks on business. Business banks on us. Standard Bank. It can be. Standard Bank is an authorized financial services and registered credit provider. T's and C's apply.
Phil Craig from the Cape Independence Advocacy Group. In the elections last week, given all of the coverage that we've given anyway to freeing the Cape, getting it independent from the rest of South Africa, whether the results of the local election was much of an endorsement for that approach?
So, look, I think from our point of view, we ended up exactly where we wanted to be, which was positive. We expected to have secessionist parties between 5% and 6%, and they ended up at 5.4%. So we ended up exactly where we expected to be. And I think, you know, this is one of the great misnomers, actually, which is a sort of a terminal problem for us, where people want to always equate support for the Cape Independence Party, or the Cape Party as then was, which is obviously a very small party, with Cape Independence. When obviously we've polled twice, and we know that the vast majority of Cape Independence supporters actually vote for the DA. And I think that's obviously a fairly logical position. They want the DA as a national government. They vote for the DA as a national government. They just never get it. And therefore Cape Independence is what allows the people of the Cape to get the government that they keep voting for. So what we saw was a big increase. So in 2016, parties that openly endorse Cape Independence, which obviously doesn't include the DA, had 0.1% of the vote, and that increased to 5.4% of the vote, which was this window 5 to 6%. So from that point of view, we were delighted. It was where we expected. And obviously what was very interesting was perhaps the bigger picture, which was the real ideological shift that we've seen in these elections away from sort of the dominant centralist parties, you know, the ANC and the EFF, towards much more regional, federalist devolved, or I think they call them the micro-regional parties now. There's a definite change towards people taking control of their own circumstances. And that is very, very compatible and very, very positive for Cape Independence.
It's an interesting point you make, and I'd like to explore that. If we can just start off by what you call secessionist parties, who went out with the agenda of we want the Cape to be independent. How do you quantify that?
Obviously, these are local government elections, so the primarily voting thing is service delivery, and so Cape Independence is a side issue in these specific elections. That's why obviously we will want a referendum, which is a specific test on Cape Independence. But in terms of how do we classify secessionist parties, we clarify it as parties who have Cape Independence expressly stated in their manifestos or in their constitutions, and there are three parties that do that. That there's the Freedom Front Plus, there's the Cape Coloured Congress, and there's the Cape Independence Party. And they are the three parties. And the Freedom Front got Freedom Front Plus got 3% of the vote, up from 0.7 in 2016. And a bit more in 2019, I haven't got the number here. The Cape Coloured Congress is a new party, hasn't contested before, and it got 1.8% of the vote. And then the Cape Independence Party was up from 0.1% in 2016 to 0.5%. So they're the three parties that we're including in that list.
Let's just unpack that again. So on the city of Cape Town, there were 231 party seats. And the Freedom Front had 4 seats. The Cape Independence Party, that's where they got their seat, was in the city of Cape Town. The Cape Coloured Congress, they also got their first seats, and they picked up 7 seats in Cape Town. So there's going to be quite a few people in Cape Town, at least, who are supporting this. And Cape Town being the mother city, one presumes that that's where most of the noise is going to be made. Are you expecting them to actually put this on any agendas?
Well, look, absolutely. I think it will be on the agenda. I actually hope that the people who've been elected in local government elections will first and foremost serve the people that have elected them in the capacity in which they've been elected. And I think that will be their first priority, and rightly so. But absolutely, the Cape Independence is, you know, it's already in the zeitgeist. It's already under discussion. You know, actually, we already have agreement that we're going to have referendums in the Western Cape, and we already have agreement that there's going to be a question on Cape Independence. So it's, you know, this isn't some watershed moment. We had that agreement before the elections. And, you know, one of the things that we worked hard for, you know, there was an understanding that the majority of Cape Independence supporters vote DA, and the majority of DA voters support Western Cape Independence, and in many ways how we arrived at the referendum agreement was an understanding that it was in nobody's best interest to force people to choose between voting for the DA and Cape Independence when they support both, and allowing people to have the democratic choice in a referendum allowed people then a much more freer vote in the local government elections, and I think that's where we are. I think certainly, you know, Cape Independence was already being discussed. It'll continue to be discussed in the city of Cape Town Council, but I think it's interesting that your focus is on the city of Cape Town, where our focus is very much on the Western Cape, and I think that's where the difference in our numbers come. You know, the support for the Freedom Front, for example, is much more rural, so their support was much stronger outside of the city of Cape Town than in. So you'll see that the Cape Coloured Congress and the Cape Independence Party have got their seats inside the city of Cape Town. That the vast majority of the Freedom Front ones are in the rest of the Western Cape, and they will be in coalition governments in many municipalities around the Western Cape now, and you know, that's a change of the political landscape for sure.
So are you then anticipating that the referendum that you've spoken about will occur before the 2024 national elections?
So the last time I spoke to the DA, they were anticipating that the referendum bill, because the legislation has to fall in place first, and the referendum bill was going to be before the committee stage they were expecting in November, so this month. And then obviously that depends on how it's dealt with by the ANC and the other parties in Parliament. That's the unknown part here. When the DA were not expecting too much opposition, they were thinking that around about 6 months to see this bill through Parliament, and then after that, obviously we'd have to press on. That felt a little optimistic to me, but I mean, yeah, they certainly are far more experienced in this than I, who have no experience at all. And we're in uncharted territory. And what we don't know, we know that the ANC and the EFF are going to make a stand on Cape independence. But, you know, what we don't know is, are they going to make the stand in Parliament, where they try and stop the bill being put in place, which would then mean they were going against the constitution, or are they going to let that bill pass and make their stand at the referendum itself, or are they going to let the referendum take place and in the post-referendum negotiations? So that's the unknown quantity here. We're assuming about 18 months if we assume that the bill is passed within sort of 6 to 9 months, and then perhaps the same again to get us towards a referendum. But I mean, it's speculation. It's informed speculation, but that's what we're working on at this point in time, and we'll obviously revise those timelines as we see what happens in Parliament with the Electoral Commission Amendment Act bill.
And the key takeaway from your perspective from the local elections is that the support for Cape independence has actually grown.
No, interesting enough, no, it wouldn't be. I think that's something that's a useful aside. I think actually, if you ask me what were the key takeaways from the local government elections, first and foremost, I would say that the ideological divide between the Western Cape and the rest of South Africa has been affirmed most emphatically once again. And if we look at parties, so for example, in the Western Cape, the ANC and the EFF combined got 23.8% of the vote. And if we remove the Western Cape and the rest of South Africa, they got 61.2% of the vote. So we've got this clear, which has always been this clear, clear ideological divide between the Western Cape and the rest of South Africa. And now we're in a situation that 20.4% of voters in the Western Cape voted for the ANC. So the party that's making all of the major political decisions is doing so with the support of 1 in 5 voters, and 4 out of 5 voters have rejected the party that's making all of the major decisions, and that's frankly untenable. So the basis for Cape independence has been strengthened, and then what we've seen is we obviously the DA are a federalist party, the Freedom Front are a federalist party, the IFP are a federalist party, and then we've had all of these smaller local ones, you know, up in Cedarburg, the Cedarburg Party CFRA, we've seen ICORSA do well, we've seen the Patriotic Alliance, who aren't a regional party but they're a special interest party, you know, in terms of the coloured vote, the Cape Coloured Congress, we've seen several residents association groups that have done well. So what we've actually seen, and if you put those together, 65% of voters in this election in the Western Cape are voting for parties to support something other than the unitary state. They want more devolved power, they want federalism, or they want independence. And even in the rest of South Africa, that now has got to between 35 and 40%. So it's fundamental. It's fundamental. I think what we're seeing what we're continuing to see actually is the breakdown of the unitary state. And some of that, this now is formally, it's in an election. We're seeing the appetite of voters for a more devolved structure of power. And actually, as the central government collapses, we're seeing the de facto devolvement of power at the same time. And I think that's going to be the story of the next few years. As I was waiting to come online, I see now we're looking increasingly likely that the ANC and the EFF are going to be in coalitions in Gauteng, and perhaps in Durban too. I'm not sure about that. And I think that is, you know, a tragedy, actually, a real tragedy. And I think that will probably tip South Africa over the edge and actually would be positive to Cape independence. But I can take no joy in that whatsoever. An ANC-EFF coalition is nothing short of a disaster.
I'm Justin Roberts of BizNews, and with me today is CEO of Exemplar, Jason McCormick. Jason, you've been somewhat of a regular BizNews contributor following the aftermath of the July riots. Exemplar, by way of background, is a township-focused real estate company, and this was one of the worst affected businesses by the civil unrest. Exemplar posted its half-year results today. Before we get into the nitty-gritty of that, Jason, how are your properties doing in the affected areas?
Justin, yeah, thanks very much. It's obviously been a tumultuous time for us because we've got a business to run that is continuing to operate. The majority of our business wasn't affected by the unrest. 5 out of the 23 projects were, developments were. And we're building other developments at the same time. So getting our business up and running, those businesses that were affected up and running, has been quite a stretch, but it's galvanized our team. I tell you what, we're operating at a much higher level now. I think, the duress has been good for us, the stress and the pressure. So as I said before, these black swans will just get out of our way and let us do our business. We're now operating at a much higher cadence than we ever have, and it has been good for us. So certainly the 4 out of the 5 in Exemplar are, for all intents and purposes, rebuilt. We should have, of those 4, 100% trading by the start of December. The 5th one, Edendale Mall, hasn't commenced yet because of the sheer magnitude of that damage. And we're still finalizing the nitty-gritty, the minutiae on the scope of that rebuild. But, fortunately, Sazeria has accepted liability and loss of income and the scope on the others, and we're almost there on Edendale. So certainly from our side, we are looking forward, and we're looking forward again now that the results are behind us. All intents and purposes, all the rest of the portfolio trading incredibly well. Unfortunately for others, particularly in the areas where there were unrest affected other centres where we managed to save out, we've seen a massive uptick in footfall across areas like in Alex Mall, in the Mall of Tembisa, quite literally 40% increase in footfall and turnover. So whilst it's been bad for the areas that were affected, those that weren't have shown really positive growth. And as I say, it all happened in July. We managed to get most 3 of the 5 up and running partially within a couple of weeks after the unrest. Teku Plaza in Newcastle will only get up and running. We're aiming for Black Friday, just before Black Friday. So all intents and purposes, 4 of the 5 Black Friday will be mostly trading again. Edendale is going to take a little bit longer.
There's been no withholding of dividends, rather a generous payout ratio. We've seen withholdings of dividends from other REITs during this COVID-19 pandemic. Does that show confidence in the road to recovery, that there's no need to withhold cash flow right now because you're confident that cash flow will restore and that things will go on as per normal in the coming months?
Well, I think the withholding of dividends in the sector has been more a shoring up of balance sheets and sorting out LTV ratios. We've never had a problem with our LTV ratios. They've always been below 40 and still remain below 40. So, yeah, we haven't felt the need to withhold dividends. Certainly, in terms of the interim payment, we have received only 20 million thus far from Sazeria. In terms of the loss of income, we haven't distributed that. But in terms of what we have once again distributed 100% of our distributable income. And as you would have seen from our results, it's a significant 26% up on the corresponding period last year, irrespective of the fact that the riots did happen towards the last third of that period.
Net asset value per share was up year on year, which seems somewhat counterintuitive given the destruction of a portion of your property portfolio in July. How is this the case?
Well, I think, other than the, as I mentioned, Edendale, which has suffered damage, but the reality is that there is still significant interest for the tenants to come back. What we have done in the past year as well, we've added the Mall of Tembisa into our portfolio. So that has helped shore it up a bit. In terms of NAV per share, those are the main drivers behind the steady growth. It wasn't a huge increase in NAV per share, but it was still positive, just like our positive rental reversions on the renewals. We had a positive increase in terms of our renewals. And so whilst it isn't groundbreaking, it isn't double digit, it is still positive, which I think in this environment and relative to the market is very positive.
Of the affected properties from the July riots, what's been the tenant retention rate following the event? Have the lion's share of those SMMEs, those micro, small size businesses managed to get themselves up on their feet and start operating?
So more than just the lion's share. To date, we've only got two tenants that aren't going to renew, and they were both SMMEs, and we've replaced them both with blue chip national tenants. So unfortunately, two of them weren't able to, 80 square and 120 square meters. So out of the total of 110,000 square meters, less than 200 square meters out of 110,000 square meters, not a bad loss ratio, I would think.
And in terms of rental holidays, will there need to be any rental holidays for any of your clients or tenants rather going forward?
Well, you know, I think it comes back to that supervening impossibility of performance, which was the overriding legal proposition. You know, what we looked at during COVID, you can't charge people if they don't have beneficial occupation. And likewise, during this, people that can't trade, we can't charge them rental because they haven't had beneficial occupation of their stores. So absolutely, there has been a rental holiday close on 20 million worth of rental in the period that we've just reported on, 18 in the high 18 million that we've had to effectively write off or claim from Sasria. But as I say, Sasria has accepted liability for the claim, and although we haven't distributed that, we don't distribute money that we don't have in our bank. So we'll never distribute out of borrowings because the money is promised to us. And so we'll always err on the side of caution. We're holding back until everything is in the bank. And then whether we just declare a special dividend or how we handle that when the time arrives, we'll deal with that, cross that bridge when we get to it.
Lastly, Jason, the last time we spoke, it was on the Mamelodi development that was taking place in the partnership with Putprop. What's the progress been like there?
It's been fantastic, to be honest. The main builders on site, the earthworks are mostly complete. We're already starting with the construction of the shop right on that. So everything is 100% on program there. Since we last spoken, we've opened Flagstaff Square in Eastern Cape, 11,000 square meters in the rural town of Flagstaff, the old Ponderland. That's traded incredibly well. That's given us a lot of confidence to really expand our push into the Eastern Cape. I love rural development. As I said to Alec after the riots, you know, it really make a massive difference. And we've turned that town on its head. From being a really forgotten, dusty backwater, we've added something that's really special. And the turnovers have been amazing. The tenants are smiling from ear to ear. And they're saying, well, what's next in the Eastern Cape for us? So certainly that's added a lot of emphasis to my drive to expand into the Eastern Cape. At the same time, the development of Mount Freer, now called Pobaka, in the Eastern Cape is progressing well. That will open the day before Mamelodi in October next year. So October will be a busy time for our openings next year. Idutra's going out to the market, just gone out to the market also in the Eastern Cape. And we've got a whole bunch of other really exciting ones coming on. Great tenant interest. And I suppose as long as we continue doing our job well, and we keep on looking after our consumers, looking after our communities, and looking after our tenants and making sure that they're making good returns and showing good growth on their numbers, well, then we hope they continue to support us. And that's the benefit of launching, you know, and having a history of launching successful developments where the tenants trade well. You're able to convince them to go to areas they may never have heard of before. Peter Engelbrecht, the shop right, I heard in one of the board meetings saying, these McCormick's, they find places I've never heard of in my life before for us to look at. So, you know, that's what we do. We operate in the frontier areas where angels dare to tread and where people don't know about. But I tell you what, there are people there with wants, needs, desires, and we aim to continue fulfilling those as we progress. So certainly from our side, it is great to have come through what has been without a doubt the most challenging period in our history. There's no doubt about it. You know, you take COVID, and the disruption that happened there, and then you add the unrest, there's been a tough time. I think, you know, we'll all enjoy the December break, but we're all filled with a lot of positivity. We were about 21 of our team went down to the Flagstaff opening just because we needed to get away and people to get involved just to see how fundamentally our development and what we do changes the social landscape in the places we go. And that was there for all to see. So everyone's come back. We're all pumped up and we're really looking forward to a positive year, as I say, as long as the macros and these unforeseen black swan events can kind of just stay out of our way. You know, I'm very positive what the future can hold. And as long as we're doing what we're doing in the way that we're doing it, we're all having a lot of fun doing what we're doing, which is great. It's nice to really enjoy the work we're doing and to be able to deliver results like we have. I think I'm very proud of the results that we have.
This Currency Focus is proudly brought to you by Treasury One, South Africa's leading treasury solutions company that unlocks financial value for your business.
I'm Justin Roberts of BizNews, and with me today is Treasury One's currency expert, Andre Siliers. There's been a lot of volatility in the rand since we last spoke around 2 weeks ago. The rand pushed out all the way to around the 15 rand 40 cent level before settling in around the 15 rand level against the US dollar. What's driving the rand's volatility at the moment?
Yes, good afternoon, Justin. What's driving the volatility? What we had seen last week was the upward move was firstly due to not such a good amount of figures that came out of China. But the primary thing last week was really the Federal Reserve meeting that was taking place and the emphasis on quantitative easing and the change to the policy on that, hence the tapering of that, and then the possible impact of that on interest rate increases. And word was that we could expect the Federal Reserve to most probably announce earlier interest rate increases and substantial amounts of quantitative easing tapering. Those amounts eventually came in a little bit less than what the market anticipated, and Mr. Powell also reiterated that they will not change at this stage in terms of what they expect on interest rate changes.
There's been so much focus on the Fed and Jerome Powell's actions, but in South Africa specifically, do you expect the governor of the Reserve Bank to increase rates at the next policy meeting? And if he does, how will that affect the rand?
Well, we've seen the petrol price increases coming through at the end of November, end of October, beginning of November, which was very, very sharp increases. Definitely will have quite a drastic impact on our inflation rate. Now, although a change in interest rates will not change anything in terms of where petrol prices will go to, it will certainly impact on where inflation can go to and the stopping of further inflation. Also places ahead of the curve in terms of what the Federal Reserve might do. And we had seen that the Reserve Bank's always been ahead of the curve for a number of years. So my expectation is that with all these massive increases that can be expected in inflation, a Christmas period where we could also see a bit of demand coming through, most probably some price increases coming through, and those increases in the fuel price filtering through to price increases of other products. I can foresee that Mr. Kanyahu would most probably look towards the first quarter of next year in changing interest rates. I still think that we'll go through the 2021 year without any changes, but very, very soon in the new year, I would expect a quarter of a percent increase in interest rates.
What's the general sentiment around emerging market currencies as a basket at the moment?
Well, we are seeing commodity pricing pick up again, and with Mr. Powell signaling that they will not change their stance on monetary policy changes in terms of interest rates, there is a bit of a risk-on situation in the emerging markets again, and we are seeing the emerging markets seeing some benefit and a correction of what we had seen as the adverse movements last week. I foresee that that will continue. I foresee that commodity prices will remain at fairly high levels, and especially South Africa, then being a commodity currency as well, will benefit from that. And if we see a change in our interest rates, then definitely that will also benefit South Africa. And I think we could most probably see changes in interest rate policies from other emerging markets as well, which will then benefit them. But I think the more interesting one this week is sort of a shift away from all these things to a something more local, as Mr. Gordon Gwana is having his medium-term budget speech.
What do the charts or the technical analysis patterns tell us about the short-term price action and the rand-dollar price?
Well, short-term actions with the rand having broken below the 15 level again, if it closes here, especially today, below the 15, then I think the technical chart tells us that we could most probably target the 1480, 1485 levels again, and that would be in line with my expectations for this time of the year. So even on the technical charts, we are looking at some positiveness, and that's across the board on the emerging markets.
And from a long-term perspective, we've seen this persistent weakening of the rand over the last 15 years. Do you expect that to continue in the next 15 years, looking at a much longer-term outlook?
That's an interesting question. And if we look at the inflation rate differentials between ourselves and our big trading counterparts throughout the world, over the last 15 years, we've been consistently very much higher than our trading counterparts, which at this point in time is not the case anymore. Our inflation is actually slightly lower than some of that of our counterparts. So I do not foresee where in previous years we had to weaken to compensate for that big differential in inflation rates, that we need to do that in the next couple of years going forward. So no, my answer there would be no, that we will not see that. We will most probably see that the rand returns to somewhat less of a weakening over the next couple of years. But we do have some serious domestic factors in terms of our economy that could impact on that. But then the weakening would be because of other factors other than inflation rate differentials that we weakened for over the last number of years. But once again, I get back. This week, we'll hear Mr. Gordon Gwana speaking about the medium-term budget, and that's very, very important. He's got to give us a very clear indication of what his rubber stamp on the economy will be, how he plans out to return the economy to growth. We'll see what his plans are in terms of social spending, further welfare, social welfare allowances that could possibly in the offing. He would give us an indication on the possibility of tax changes. You know, so yes, he's going to give us some good news in terms of what our shortfall as a percentage of GDP is. He will give us some good news in terms of what our borrowings of his percentage of GDP is. Those are going to be positive numbers, but that will not be because we borrowed less. That will not be because we spend it less. That simply because of a change in the GDP figures when it was announced that GDP is a little bit bigger than what was anticipatedly initially anticipated. It's 11% higher. That changes those ratios significantly. But this week, a very, very important week to see what the three-year and the five-year term forecast sees for South Africa by our Minister of Finance.
Andre, a lot of focus is put on the rand-dollar price. What are the drivers of the rand versus, say, the top two major European currencies, that being the euro and the pound?
Well, those are also very important trading counterparts of ours, and you know, what happens to the value of the dollar will definitely influence the value of those two currencies significantly, which will impact on the cross rates. So there, I think everybody is forecasting that the dollar will not fall out of bed. There will not be a massive decline in the dollar value, that it could most probably strengthen a little bit, which would weaken those two currencies. But I think Britain would be slightly isolated from that in the sense that, you know, the whole Brexit saga is behind us, and they can continue with their economy under the new rules and regulations going forward. And that could benefit the pound a little bit, which could see that the weakening of the rand against the pound is a little bit more significant than what it is against the dollar. And we could see that trading closer to the 21 and 22 levels, well, above the 21, closer to the 22 levels during the course of next year, especially towards the end of the year. But on the euro, I do not foresee that the euro will strengthen or that will continue its weakening path against the dollar, and hence that cross rate will be a little bit better for the South Africans. Our weakening would be a little bit less against the euro.
This Currency Focus was proudly brought to you by Treasury One, South Africa's leading treasury solutions company that unlocks financial value for your business. Well, thanks for being with us today, and we look forward to being back in your company tomorrow. Same time, same place, from the BizNews team. Until then, cheerio. You've been listening to the Power Hour, brought to you by the team at BizNews.